Well, I have a wonderful electronic invention I want you to see. It looks something like this.
What's going on, Curiosity Builders? I'm Chris Martin, and you're listening to Getting Work to Work, a weekly podcast for creative entrepreneurs, makers, artists, podcasters, writers, filmmakers, designers, and coders who are on a mission of bringing their ideas to life by creating new things and getting their work to work. Whether you're just starting out or have been at this creative life for some time, I hope you'll learn something new in this podcast, challenge your assumptions about what is possible, and chase big ideas so you can become who you were born to be. If love is the most powerful force in the universe, why do we often leave it out of work? This is the question that extreme leader Steve Farber answers in his upcoming book, Love is Just Damn Good Business. Do what you love in the service of people who love what you do. In this interview episode of Getting Work to Work, Steve and I explore the business case for love and how it's the ultimate competitive advantage as we move forward into the future. We also touch on his background in creativity, from singing songs to writing books, how he brings his creativity to the stage when speaking, and what he has learned about the impact of his work on others over the years. Show notes and links to resources mentioned in this episode can be found at gwtw.co/314. You'll also find links to stream the show on the major podcast platforms and an opportunity to sign up for my email newsletter, The Curiosity Lab. Each week, I send out some thoughts on curiosity along with books, videos, podcasts, and other resources blowing my mind as well. So, Steve, welcome to Getting Work to Work. What's one thing people should know about you?
Oh, wow. We're starting with the softball questions.
Absolutely.
Yeah, great. I think I'm going to say primarily that I am, even though I'm in the business world, that's my thing, I am primarily a creative.
How so?
Well, I'm a musician. I'm a songwriter.
Oh, cool.
I'm a writer, and I view work as a creative process.
Very cool.
I don't feel that people really know me until they see the artist side of me.
So when you became a songwriter, who was kind of the musician or band that was like, that's it right there?
Yeah. So I have to go way back when on that one, because I started playing guitar when I was in high school and I started singing and then writing primarily because of one musician, one singer-songwriter, a guy by the name of John Prine.
John Prine. Sounds really familiar.
Yeah. So John Prine is one of these guys that is incredibly famous and nobody knows who he is. If you talk to any real singer-songwriter, they know who he is and have probably been influenced by him in some way. He just has never hit the mainstream as a classic kind of popular artist. Mm-hmm. He's kind of in that folk country singer-songwriter genre and is just a remarkable songwriter. He writes the kind of songs where you listen to it, any one of his songs, you listen to them, you say, wow, that sounds like the kind of song, like I could have written that. Because it's just so simple and there is no freaking way you could have written it. You know what I mean? It's that kind of art.
Oh, that's cool.
And it's just an amazing storyteller, lyricist. So I started listening to him back in the 70s. And that got me hooked into playing kind of Americana. That's what we call it now. Back in the days, we called it, you know, folk music. And his songs, because they were so simple, they were easy to play. So the first few years that I started singing, I was all John Prine all the time, man. I sang every one of his songs. And I even sounded a little bit like him at the time. So that's influence number one. Influence number two would be one that everybody knows about, and that's Bob Dylan, you know, just from the sheer artistry of his lyrics more than anything else.
Knowing you as a writer, it's fascinating to see the connection of songwriting to writing and that storytelling is the path that kind of goes between those two worlds.
Yeah, it really is one of the paths for sure. For me, I've been in the business of leadership development is probably the generic way of saying it for 30 years now. Wow. And a lot of that is writing and a lot of it is speaking. You know, I do a lot of keynote speaking and that characterizes what I do as it does any decent keynote speaker. It's about the stories that you tell. mm-hmm. and the way that you tell them and the relevance of the stories to the audience. And, you know, can the stories are an illustration of how a particular idea or principle plays out in real life. And people listening to the story can relate to it because they've had similar stories of their own mm-hmm. or they find inspiration in it. It makes the abstract concrete. There are a lot of reasons for it. So yes, good storytelling is central to great songwriting and it's central to great books and it's central to great speeches. But also for me, I love the artistry of words. Mm-hmm. I love playing with words. And that's mm-hmm. why when I'm writing something, it just takes me a long time because every sentence, every paragraph has to sound right. It's got a musicality to it.
Yes.
Which might sound odd coming from a business writer.
Not at all.
But I mean, seriously, when I'm writing a paragraph or a sentence, it's got to sound right. I mean, the rhythm, if it's like this. Can you hear that?
I can, yeah.
Over and over again, it's awful. But if it starts. I mean, that's interesting. Sentences have rhythm and words have musicality to them. That's the kind of thing that kind of trips my trigger.
Wow. So would you say that's what keeps you kind of fresh and alive when it comes to passion and energy in a 30-year career?
It's part of it. It's part of it. In terms of the actual, you know, expression side of the equation, mm-hmm. yeah, I love telling a good story. I love playing with the nuances. But more important than that is the impact. I don't mean this to sound self-serving. Mm-hmm. I think it's something all of us need to pay attention to regardless of what we do.
Yeah.
But my work, the ideas of my work in this field that I call extreme leadership, have a huge impact on people. Mm. And I mean that, you know, in a positive way, mm-hmm. yeah. a good impact as opposed to a devastating impact. You know what I mean? So that's really what keeps it fresh because from the standpoint of the guy with the body of work, mm-hmm. you know, because I've written several books, you know, the new one's coming out, depending on when you're listening to this, you know, September 2019. So it's either already out or will be coming out. So that's my fourth book. And I've done several editions of my first three books. So, you know, I've had lots of books out there and they've been out there for a while. The first book, The Radical Leap, came out in its first edition in 2004. So that's 15 mm-hmm. years now yeah, that these wow. ideas have been out there in some form or another. So for me, these ideas are part of who I am and can seem like, well, it should be obvious. It should be obvious to everybody. But it's not. So what keeps this fresh for me is hearing how people either who have been exposed to these ideas for the first time or people that have been using them for a long time to great effect. When I hear what they're doing with it and how they're responding to it, that makes it fresh for me and it reminds me why I do this work, and that's to have an impact. Right.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is I've never claimed to have this all figured out. I'm not the guy with all the answers. So I learn such amazing things from my clients and my readers and my so-called fans mm-hmm. because they're applying it in ways that I never would have thought of. Mm. So it's a reciprocal thing. I learn on the one hand, I'm a teacher. On the other hand, I'm a perpetual student. And what's fascinating about that from an author or so-called thought leader perspective, I'm a student of my own stuff. I mean, yeah. It sounds odd, but it's like, oh shit, I never thought you could do it that way. That's pretty cool.
That is cool.
Which then gives me a whole other set of ideas that I can teach to other people. So I kind of end up being in this conduit sort of a role as yeah. opposed to being the fountainhead of great wisdom, which I've never claimed to be. I'm an observer, right? So yeah. that's my thing. I'm an observer. I learn. I love people. I learn a lot from so many clients and so many different industries over the years mm-hmm. that it's I just also happen to have a talent for communicating things in a way that makes complex ideas really simple and accessible to a lot of people. So that's what trips my trigger every day.
That's cool. It sounds like, too, as you're describing what you do, it's really about jamming, but with ideas instead of music.
Now you're talking my language.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like you're standing up there, you're taking what's available, and you're finding the way forward, you know, to something magical and life-changing.
You know, if you look at any speaker's website, mm-hmm. right? So stevefarber.com is, you know, there's a lot on there about my speaking services and lots of videos and snippets of my talks and all that. Mm-hmm. One of the classic things that you find on a topic sheet, one of mine is actually called the Extreme Leadership Jam Session.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And the reason is, the setup there is I start out by just sharing a few ideas, kind of my framework for extreme leadership, which is love, energy, audacity, and proof. Mm. And a little explanation of that, which is kind of like saying, this is the key that we're playing in. Mm. And then from there, we just take it wherever it goes. So I turn it over to the audience, and they formulate a series of questions or comments or whatever. And I just start fielding it, and we jam. We just take it wherever it goes. There's no set list. There's no music sheet that we're playing off of, which is good because I can't read music anyway. So it's a jam session. So yes, in many ways, that's what this whole thing is. That's what any evolution of a set of ideas is, essentially, is a jam session, right? We're listening mm-hmm. to each other. We're responding to each other. We're improvising. We're making, you know, otherwise known as making stuff up. And then something works, you try it again, you do it again, you expand it, you pick up on a theme, you all jump in, you develop it together. It's one big jam session. That's exactly right.
What's interesting too is as I'm hearing you talk about jam sessions and being a keynote speaker with this mentality, it's like that's got to really stand out when everyone is seemingly playing the same song out in the world.
Yeah. And there are ways of actually illustrating that experientially and metaphorically. So, for example, I will often use my guitar in my keynotes to illustrate what happens when you tap into something that you're passionate about,
Cool. Even
in congruous settings. So when people hire a business guy, they don't expect him to come in with, you know, a guitar slung over his shoulder. And it also gives me a chance to, you know, play music in front of lots of people.
That's awesome.
Which is something that I, you know, fantasized about when I was younger. So, and then also I have a partnership with some really accomplished singer-songwriters by the name of the Brothers Koren, K-O-R-E-N, Isaac and Torold Koren. You know, they've toured with Pink and Coldplay and Rod Stewart and
cool, and
they're just really accomplished musicians. So we do a thing together where we actually take, as a way to illustrate a model for high performance, we use music to give our clients the actual experience of the creative process and then performing at their highest level. And the way we do that, we facilitate a process where the group will write, rehearse, and perform an entirely original song together.
Wow.
So in a 90-minute session, we go from scratch to literally having the audience write, for example, their new company song. And it's always good. It's not, you know, some cheesy little jingle. I mean, it's really good. Mm. And then we go into the studio and record it for them professionally afterwards.
Oh, cool.
So my point is that music is, in the creative process, it is in and of itself a creative process. It also stands as a very compelling metaphor, very, you know, strong, applicable metaphor for any kind of work-related process, any kind of business process, any kind of, you know, innovation process in a context that we tend to think of as something completely different from music.
Hmm. So as you're describing this world of, you know, they're going to write their company song in this session, do you just see the fear and panic wash over their face at the beginning?
Yeah. What gives you that idea? Yeah. So part of the key in this is to make, and this is both true for the process itself and also as the principle that we want people to learn, mm-hmm. we've got to make the environment safe. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that the fear is removed or the trepidation is removed. What it means is we have to remove the fear of judgment. Mm-hmm. People are afraid to, if you look at it in the world of work, mm-hmm. and you know, I actually address this quite a bit in the new book, which is called Love is Just Damn Good Business, right? If I live in an environment at work that I love being in, where I've got that strong connection with my coworkers, I am much more likely to speak up, offer ideas, contribute without any fear of being labeled as stupid or being judged in any way. That's the number one thing that keeps us from contributing, is because we're afraid that we're going to sound stupid. So we got to create an environment that encourages people to speak up. And the flip side of that is to speak up even without the expectation that my, what I think is a brilliant idea, is ever going to be used. Because there may be a better idea, and my expressing my idea might lead to a better idea. And that's part of the process as well, right? In that experience that we create live, we create the environment that makes it very safe for people to contribute. And for some people, it sounds a little counterintuitive, but the contribution, the literal contribution that they might make to the creation of a song is by making no contribution whatsoever. Just by being present and responsive to the other ideas. So in other words, we never put people on the spot. We don't drag them up on stage. You know, if you can imagine, you know, an introvert who's got, you know, some level of social anxiety coming into a speech because their company is there and they have no choice. And then suddenly some schmuck on the stage pulls them up in front of everybody and says, "Sing." I mean, how awful would that be? So we don't do that. Right.
That's good.
But then there are people that really love that, and we give them an opportunity. So everybody contributes in their own way. But this is really interesting about the nature of songwriting. And this is a legal thing, actually. If you are in the room and part of a group that's involved in the creation of a song, whether or not you contributed one note or one word, you are still considered a co-writer of the song.
Wow.
So if you have a group of, let's say, you know, a few hundred people writing an original song together, as daunting as that sounds, literally everybody in that room is a contributor to that song, whether or not they ever literally, you know, contributed a thought or an idea.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool stuff. And the same is true at work. We all contribute to whatever environment we're working in. I mean, obviously, if I'm a solopreneur or an artist and I'm working on my own, that's a different dynamic. But whenever you put several human beings together in one location, whether it's a company or a project or a film or an album, you know, when you bring people together, you're essentially creating a culture, right? There is a culture, de facto, there's a culture. And what we want is for that culture to be characterized by love more than anything else. And, you know, a mutual care and concern for each other's hopes, needs, dreams, and aspirations. We want everybody to commit it to the best possible outcome, whatever that outcome is, whether it's a, you know, a new software program or a new song or a new piece of art. Doesn't matter. When we're all working to produce that, and we want the best possible outcome, and we want to create the environment that's going to give us the greatest likelihood of doing that, the best way to get there is to create an environment that people love working in. I can't imagine a scenario where somebody would say, you know what, I would really appreciate coming to work with a bunch of jerks. I don't want to be inspired by anybody. I just want to get in there and be miserable and collect my paycheck and go home. Now, that does describe what a lot of people experience, but I don't believe it describes what people really want.
Right.
So why not focus on creating an environment that people are going to be inspired by, that are going to be engaged in, that are going to look forward to, because that's when we do our best possible work. And that's what we all want, whether we're business people or artists. We're all looking for the same great outcome.
So what observations in the business world were you making that prompted you to write Love Is Just Damn Good Business?
Yeah, it's and that really is what it came from, observations in the business world. So there was one really interesting idea that I learned from my mentors when I first started really focusing on the leadership element of business, and this was back in the mid-90s.
Okay.
So I did a stint at a place called the Tom Peters Company. Tom Peters is one of the great management thinkers of our day.
Absolutely.
That's where I cut my teeth. And the president of the company at the time was Jim Kouzes, who was the co-author of The Leadership Challenge with Barry Posner. And these guys, you know, now it's been 35, almost 40 years of their research on what great leaders are. Mm-hmm. And that was one of Jim's observations from their work, is that leaders used the word love frequently when talking about why they led, you know, what inspired them to step up. So you'd hear, you know, I loved the product. I loved the people I was working with. I loved my clients. I loved the values that we stood for. I loved the future we can create together. I loved this industry that I'm in. That would just come up a lot in just a really natural way. So obviously, I certainly wasn't the first and absolutely not the only person to recognize this. I mean, this has been, I didn't invent love. What I noticed, though, is that it was so prevalent, and yet we so rarely focused on it. So one of the observations that led to this book was I would talk to executives in private, one-on-one, and conversations like this would happen. Hey, okay, you got a great team. Tell me about your team. Oh, I love my team. And then I'd hear stories about these amazing people on their team and the great work that they're doing. And that, you know, these people are my heroes. I love what they're doing with their lives and the contribution that they're making. Love, 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 love. And then I would have the same conversation or ask the same question with that same person in a public setting, like maybe at a team meeting. I say, so tell me, what do you think about this team? Oh, they're great. So you hear the same thing. They're great. They do amazing work. But the love thing just disappeared, right? It contributed to my realization that we are operating under a collective delusion that says love has no place in business. We've been kind of cultivated to believe this somehow through our just, you know, conditioning, I guess. It's just not true. That's why it's a delusion. We believe it, but it's not true. And when we start to focus on it and say, look, doesn't it seem a little odd that you want love in every aspect of your life? And in fact, success in your life is often characterized by the presence of love. You want to love your kids. You want them to love you. You want to love your spouse or significant other. You want him or her to love you. You want to love your friends. You want them to love you. You want love everywhere you go. And then you go to work and it no longer applies. Huh. Oh, no, not here. That doesn't make any sense. It's just something we came to believe because we've been trained on some level that if you show love in business, you're being weak. You're making bad decisions. You're letting your emotions get the best of you, blah, blah, blah. And that's just not true. But it's also, this is not an either or scenario. Yes, rational, logical, analytical decision-making is important in business. Yeah, that's all true. But that kind of approach has its application. It doesn't apply equally well to how you create the right kind of dynamics among the team and how you attract the right people and what keeps them engaged. That's not a purely rational, logical approach, right? Yeah. There's something deeper going on there. So it's a both and scenario. I'm not saying love is damn good business and therefore, you know, analytics is not. No, it's both. This is what's going to give, it's the love thing, it's that connection of the heart that brings greater efficiency, greater effectiveness, greater productivity to everything else that we're doing. We just have to stop sacrificing one for the other. So it's not that we're bringing something in that's not there, it's already there. We just have to focus on it in a different way and then ask the question, okay, so if we really were in an environment characterized by love, what would that look like? In other words, what would we do differently? How would we conduct our business differently? This is a phrase that I call operationalizing love, which sounds a little paradoxical, but it's really not. Because if we don't operationalize it, then really all we're left with is a sentiment. And this is not about a sentiment. It's about a discipline and a practice that also, you know, of course, has an impact on how you feel about things. But it's that combination of starting with the right motivation and then making that real and tangible and concrete into the mechanics of how we do things.
It sounds like, too, especially in today's context, love can be one of those things where you're just like, uh-oh, lawsuit, you know, mm-hmm. you know, to some mind. But then the way you're describing it about making it operational, it now becomes almost a multiplier instead of a liability.
Yeah. So this is another problem, Chris, is that we conflate love with things that are not love, and we still call them love. Mm-hmm. So the lawsuit part of this, as in harassment, that's not love. That's not love. That's aggression. That's predation. That's not love. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we got to appeal to people's common sense in this, right?
Absolutely.
Love is more being, you know, committed to each other's success. It's not physical affection that we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. That's inappropriate in a business context. Always has been, or always should have been, mm-hmm. I should yeah. say. And now we know that it is. So it's a loaded word. So we have to be clear on what we mean and what we don't mean. But, you know, that's not love. That's something else.
Well, and it speaks to a different kind of power when it comes to love. You know, the other definition is a misuse of power, whereas what you're describing is really, you know, a power that builds everyone up.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. It's, you know, listen, it's the most, you know, some will say, philosophers will say, theologians will say that love is the most powerful force in the universe. Okay? Mm-hmm. And most people will tell you, yeah, that's true. Love is the most powerful force in the universe. But we don't use it at work. What? If it's the most powerful force in the universe, are you telling me that business exists in some other parallel universe where of course not. Okay. So all I'm asking people to do really is to consider what if this really were a place where we strove every day to encourage people to bring their hearts into what we're doing here as a business.
Yeah.
Let's just start with that. Let's just consider the possibility and see where that takes us.
I love the question, just what if in general. It's just like, by applying it to this, it's really a powerful start. And it leads to the question of, you know, when love is present in business, what are the byproducts?
Yeah.
What are the results of what if thinking?
So that's a big premise of the book. You know, it's not altruism, really. Mm-hmm. What we're suggesting is, I know this is going to sound rather obvious, given the title of the book, what we're suggesting is love is just damn good business. In other words, it should have and will have, and in our experience has had, an impact on the bottom line, on the things that you measure as a business, things like profitability, things like productivity, things like improved employee turnover, mm-hmm. better customer satisfaction numbers, or net promoter score numbers. Mm-hmm. It'll have an impact on all of those things. So we show lots of examples of companies and people that have gotten results through this approach. Because honestly, you know, I just want to remind you and remind your listeners, I'm a business guy.
Yeah.
If this didn't translate to the bottom line, it would just be kind of a nice to have, you know, discussion. Oh, wouldn't that be nice? Mm-hmm. But what I'm saying is that this is really an imperative. This is where, In this day and age in particular, I think it's always been true, but even more so now, when we live in an age of, you know, phenomenally rapid change driven by, you know, everything from technology to the social fabric of the day, mm-hmm. it's a requirement. This love is a requirement if we're going to have a competitive advantage on so many levels. If we look at the correlation between operationalizing love and the bottom line, it should be pretty tight. And as it turns out, it is. For example, and this is really kind of the business case for it in a nutshell. If your customers, the end users, the buyers of your product or service, if they are merely satisfied with what you do for them, you have no advantage. Because we expect to be satisfied wherever we go, we customers.
True.
So I can be satisfied here, I'm satisfied there. It doesn't matter. As long as I'm satisfied, I have no loyalty to you. But when your customers love you, and they actually use that language, right? They're describing an emotion. Oh, I love this product. I love Apple. I love my coffee shop on the corner. I love this place. we use those terms all the time, right? Mm-hmm. When your customers love you, that's where your payoff comes from as a business, because you're much more likely to get more of their loyalty, to get more of their money, to get more of their word of mouth. We all know this. This is nothing new. Every business person should understand that by now.
Yeah.
Okay. So if we start with that premise, then what I'm suggesting is we back it up, reverse engineer it from there. The only way to really create that product and service that customers are going to love in a meaningful and sustainable way over time is to create an environment that people love working in, to create an environment that the people who are creating and delivering those products and services love working in. If I hate it here, if I hate working here, it's going to be much more difficult for me to create something that my customer is going to love. Mm. Right?
Yeah.
The only way that we can create an environment that people love working in is if it starts with us first. So this all gets very personal very quickly. If I don't love this place, if I don't love this team, if I don't love this product, if I don't love this service, if I don't love this company, I can't create an environment that other people are going to love as well. Right? Again, just to back it up, we want our customers to love what we do for them. The only way to make that happen in a meaningful and sustainable way over time is to create an environment that people love working in. And I can't create that environment unless I love it myself first. So this all starts with the results.
Yeah.
The it's not about, you know, thinking, oh, love would be nice, and then trying to extrapolate from that how that might possibly, if we really squint, have an impact on the bottom line. So this whole approach is about, let's do this, not just because, and by the way, I think that would be good enough reason, honestly, be good enough reason. But from a business perspective, let's do it because it's going to make our business more valuable. You know, Warren Buffett has said something similar. There's this wonderful quote from him, and we quoted in the book. I quoted a lot in my speeches. He says, you know, even when he's thinking about buying a company, even when it all looks good on paper, all the analytics are there, he said, I have to sit down in the same room with the CEO. I have to look into his or her eyes. And what he's saying is, I try to see in that person's eyes whether they love the money or if they love the business. Because if they don't love the business, I'm not buying this company. I'm paraphrasing here a little bit. Mm. But if they don't love the business, I am not going to buy this company. Because if they don't love the business, then really the only thing they're interested in, likely, is the exit strategy. How quickly they can put their piece of this pie, their chunk of this money in their own pocket and get the hell out of there. And he said, I'm trying to invest in a company that's going to grow in value over time. And that's not going to happen unless the love is there.
Yeah.
And hey, that's good enough for me, Warren. I get it. So basically what he's saying is there's an actual correlation between the love in the company and the value, the actual market value of that company. Can I prove that in absolute mechanical terms? Maybe, maybe not. But there's plenty of anecdotal evidence to suggest, including our own experience as human beings, that suggests that, you know, if my heart is connected to this work, I'm going to be much more committed to it. I'm going to be more committed to my team. I'm going to do better work. I'm going to be happier at work, which is going to have an impact on my personal life in a positive way, which is going to circle back around to how much energy I have at work. And it becomes this wonderful kind of a virtuous cycle. And I think we're short-circuiting ourselves by denying that love has any place in this picture at all. Not that I feel strongly about this or anything.
Not at all. Not at all. As you were describing love and where love begins, I was thinking of the movie Bruce Almighty, where Jim Carrey is endowed with the power of God to do anything, but he's like, but you can't make people fall in love with you.
Yeah.
And it, what's, I don't know quite why I went there, but at the same time, I think sometimes we want people to love us. So it's like, you are going to love me. Why won't you love me? Instead of creating that place that allows love to happen, or just, I mean, do you hold on to it or do you let it go? You know?
Yeah, no, I think that's a really insightful question in this, because if the premise is we want our customers to love us, can you really make somebody love you?
Right.
So it's a perfectly valid question. So there's a couple of things. From a business perspective, you can get pretty close to that when it comes to people loving your product or service by being a real expert in who your customer is, right? Mm. So if you know your customer to the point where you really understand the world that they're living in, the challenges that they're facing, their likes, their dreams, their hopes, their desires, and if you can find a way to deliver your product and service in a way that contributes to the quality of their life, they're much more likely to love you. Mm. It doesn't mean that everybody will.
Right.
And internally, it's not about going out of your way to make everybody happy all the time.
Yeah, because love isn't about happiness.
Well, yeah, I mean, sometimes, you know, it's lovely when they line up and sometimes they don't, right? Yeah. I mean, I love my wife and we have times where we're in the moment, we're not particularly happy when we're having a fight or whatever. It doesn't change the love, right? Yeah. And at work, I can love this place. I can love this team and be really pissed off because we're not living up to our capabilities, for example, or we missed that really important deadline. So love is not about creating a place where everybody's happy all the time. People walk around with big goofy grins on their faces and you just stop the action and have a big group hug in the hallway. And I mean, that sounds really nauseating to me. Contrary to that is we want to strive to help people live up to their best. And we do that with a combination of kindness and high expectations. So the expectations should go up, not down. So what that means is I'm not simply trying to figure out a way to, quote, make you love me. What I'm doing is I'm acting in a way and creating an environment that shows you that I love you by making this place as conducive as possible to your doing your best possible work in a way that's going to help you fulfill your personal goals in addition to what we're doing here together.
Yeah.
And you might love that. You might not. You might decide this is the wrong place for you. And sometimes the greatest act of love that you can do for somebody is to fire them or to help them move on to somewhere else, whatever, however you euphemistically would like to say it.
Transition them to a new role.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Somewhere else.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you're right. It's this is not about, certainly not about pandering. Mm-hmm. It's about doing the best that we can. Now here's how it all comes together. So the subtitle of the book, as well as the primary sections in the book, is a phrase that I've been communicating for many, many years now. Do what you love in the service of people who love what you do. So the way that breaks down is doing what you love is important. It's the foundation for this whole thing, but it's not the whole story, right?
Right.
I want to have my connection to my work through my heart. But if all I'm doing is focusing on what I love and I don't really care about how that impacts you, as long as I'm doing what I love, that's called narcissism in the worst sense, right?
Yeah.
So yes, I'm doing what I love, but the context is in the service of people. So I'm using my heart in my work to give great value to you, whoever it is that I'm serving. Mm-hmm. So this is the old, you know, servant leadership idea, right?
Right.
I'm serving the people that I'm leading. I'm serving the people that work for me, with me, and around me. I'm serving my customers, but I'm not sacrificing myself for it. So I'm doing what I love in the service of people. And the last section is who love what you do. So this is the dynamic that we've been talking about, Chris, is not every customer is going to love what I do for them. But the ones that do, when they raise their hand and say, oh, I love you guys, that is my ideal customer.
Yeah.
And that's where we start to put more and more of our attention and turn up the volume with those folks, right? So do what you love in the service of people who love what you do. If you really don't love what I do for you, you're probably not the right customer for me. If I'm doing everything I can, if it's because I'm making a mistake or I'm doing something, you know, boneheaded, that's another story. But there are some people you're executing perfectly on the idea that you had in mind and that you have customers that really love. And there's some, it doesn't mean that everybody's going to appeal to it or be drawn to it. And that's cool. That's fine. So let's find more of those people that will.
It sounds like what you just described too is that love is not a fixed point at the end of a journey. It's really the evolution of the journey and that love grows and changes along the way.
Yeah, I should hope so. I mean, really, do you ever get to the point where you say, that's it, I've arrived. All love all the time for all beings. And I mean, maybe, listen, Honestly, I aspire to that. Would I love to be in that frame of mind? Mm-hmm. But I think that's perhaps something superhuman. Yeah. It's an evolution for all of us. Absolutely. Yeah.
I like thinking of it that way because I think it makes it attainable and something a little bit more worthwhile than just like, all right, we're here. Everyone love us now.
Yep. That's right.
Nice.
Well, you know, it's the old phrase. It's been attributed to several people. So it's kind of fallen into the category of anonymous that you should never rest on your laurels because today's laurels are tomorrow's compost.
Oh.
Whenever you feel like you've arrived, no matter what it is, mm-hmm. That's the beginning of the end because the world hasn't arrived. We're constantly changing, evolving. One would hope we're evolving
right.
versus just changing. And that means that we have to be as well.
Wow. Steve, this is great. I'm loving this. No, I'm not making a play on your book title. I'm loving where you're coming at because I think regardless of the size of your organization, I think this is love is one of those topics you need to consider.
Yes. I think it's, you know, and again, I'm a little bit biased in this, but I say this from 3 decades of experience. It's not something you may want to consider. It's something you absolutely have to consider.
Yeah.
And having said that, you know, I'll just speak personally for a second on mm-hmm. this. I've come to realize that, and I think this is true for a lot of people in the work that they do, but speaking for myself, I'm not in the business of convincing anybody of anything. Mm. It's not my job to convince people that love is just damn good business. Mm-hmm. I mean, for one thing, if somebody just really hates people, convincing them that they should love people because it's going to be good for their business is never going to go anywhere.
Right.
Because they're just going to fake it anyway. And people have a good bullshit meter. They know when we're faking it. This isn't about putting on airs. It's about authenticity, which, mm-hmm. you know, one of the big buzzwords of the day for all the right reasons. Mm-hmm. I'm not in the convincing business. I'm in the confirmation business. Mm. My job is to point this out, shine a spotlight on it. And then what happens, I see it happen literally every day of my life. There are people that say to me some variation on, I always thought I was crazy. Hmm. This is how I've always felt. This is what I've always tried to do, but I haven't done it because I didn't think it was quote unquote right. I just made air quotes there.
So you know. I heard.
I think that other people would think I was crazy. So I just kind of didn't really act on it. Mm. And what I find is when this is, people hear this as a confirmation of instincts and impulses that they've already had, and they just now have the evidence to suggest that they should act on those impulses and they step up and live more fully into what's already there, mm-hmm. that's where the magic really happens. It's not in converting the assholes. It's in giving people, not that I have the power to do this, but it kind of feels this way to some people when they read these ideas, giving people permission to do what's already there.
Yeah.
To be how they already are. That's an incredibly powerful thing. And in my experience, and I think this is the good news, in my experience, that's actually most people.
That's good.
That's not the, you know, some fringe element. That's most people. Mm-hmm. Every author should feel this about his or her book. And I feel this about mine, that we really have an opportunity to change the nature and the expectation and the experience of what it means to go to work.
Yeah.
And if we can do that, we change everything. We change everything. Mm. So coming back to one of your original questions in this great conversation, that's what keeps it fresh and alive for me every day is that purpose.
Yeah. What's interesting too is a common theme in this podcast is the value of building community, and you're actually doing that as well with your Extreme Leadership community. How would you describe that community that you've been building?
Yeah, thank you for asking. I'm really proud of it. It's grown very organically. Our expanding community is a combination of people that have read my books, mm-hmm. that have been to, you know, we do a couple of different kind of events here in San Diego. We do a public event called the Extreme Leadership Workshop, which is a one-day deep dive into the elements of love, energy, audacity, and proof as it relates to your business. Mm-hmm. And then we certify people.
Oh, cool.
to facilitate that workshop. So we have about 150 certified facilitators around the world.
Wow.
And then once a year we do an event here in San Diego called the Extreme Leadership Experience, where I bring in lots of other speakers and practitioners who have their own bodies of work that are really resonant, you know, simpatico with this, mm-hmm. but also people that have been putting these ideas into practice. And they kind of get up and share their best practices with, you know, how they operationalize love, for example. Yeah. And we've had, you know, shipping and logistics companies, collections agencies,
oh, wow.
Greeting card companies, American Greetings, for example. So this community grows on the basis of a shared set of values. And this is one of the things I really love about it. In this community, of this ever-expanding community of extreme leaders, we have business people, we have mm-hmm. corporate folks, we have entrepreneurs, we also have educators, people from the nonprofit sector, independent consultants, people that come just because they're a part of it because it brings value to their family life. I mean, it's really broad-based. What they all have in common mm-hmm. is that everybody, you know, it's what I was just talking about a minute ago. They have this instinct and this impulse and this desire to bring love more fully into the way that they work and operate every day.
Yeah, that's powerful.
And it brings together great diversity of, you know, background, country, ethnicity, religion. It transcends all of that and therefore brings together this wonderful palette of different perspectives and backgrounds.
What an ideal kind of melting pot for the learner that you are, learning from your own stuff.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's just amazing, you know, for me at my own event, because I spend so much time at other, you know, people's mm-hmm. meetings and conferences and all that, being up on stage. At my own event, I get the opportunity to do a little bit of that, but also I'm the guy sitting in the chair listening to these amazing ideas, all in support of this body of work and looking at it from different angles. I learn so much every time. We all do. Mm-hmm. And so every year it grows a little bit more, you know. So I can see a time where the Extreme Leadership Experience will have, you know, 1,000 people. But right now we're, you know, we tend to be between 1 and 200, mm-hmm. Very intimate setting, 3 days. So here's the thing. Next year is 2020. Mm-hmm. So the obvious cliche that comes along with 2020 is, you know, 2020 vision, right?
Yep.
Well, that's cool. But yeah, I imagine there'll be several conferences that will play on that theme in 2020. But for us, what's even more significant is 2020 is a leap year. And therefore, we're having our 2020 event on February 27th, 28th, and 29th, which nice. Is leap day, of course. Nice. A symbolically appropriate calendar event. And yeah, we're going to have a great time. But thank you for asking. I love this community. I love seeing it grow. And, you know, I honestly, some of my closest friends in my life, actually, I would say many of my closest friends in my life came from this work. Wow. They started out as clients, readers of my books, coming to an event. It's just kind of the nature of how we do things around here.
Wow. That's fantastic. And I think to myself, and I think to other creative entrepreneurs who are in the process of building that community, what a great example of what's possible.
Yeah. So if I were to give any advice,
please,
to anybody striving to build a community of their own, and, you know, certainly there are lots of experts in this arena. Mm-hmm. So I'm maybe just barely qualified to speak on it, but it really is about the shared values. You know, what is it that everybody in your community cares about? Why are they drawn to you and your work? What is the nature of it that draws them? That's kind of the values level, right? Mm-hmm. And then from a personal side, it's you as the builder of that community, or the shepherd of that community, or the steward of that community, whatever, mm-hmm. You need to challenge yourself to be personally involved as much as possible, establish a personal connection with as many people as possible in your community. And as your community grows and it gets harder and harder to do that, and this is what I'm about to say is a leadership principle for anybody in any role, but particularly in light of this, you know, community building challenge, you need to challenge yourself to be, as much as is humanly possible, the walking, talking, living, breathing example of what your community stands for. Oof. So for me, that's a daunting challenge, right? Mm-hmm. Because I'm in the business of teaching people to operationalize love as a business principle. Mm-hmm. Does that mean I never have days where I'm as big a schmuck as the next guy? Absolutely not. I have my bad days, but I always strive to be an example of somebody who's kind, loving, generous, present, interested in other people. And the more I can do that, the stronger the community will be and the bigger it will get over time.
Well, Steve, this has been an amazing conversation. I just have one last question for you.
Yeah.
What was the last book or podcast that blew your mind?
Oh, well, I have two answers to that question. One is I'm about to start reading a book that I expect is going to blow my mind. Because I know the author really well.
Nice.
It's called Happy Money by Ken Honda. He's a very, very popular author. And he's often referred to as like the Tony Robbins of Japan.
Okay.
And this is his first book that he's published in the US.
Cool.
So I know the principal and I know him really well. So I'm excited to start reading it. I haven't read it yet. But the last book that I've read that really falls into that blew my mind category, The Obstacle is the Way.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Ryan Holiday. That's just a great book. Very, very accessible and really helpful in an entrepreneur's journey, because I can't remember the last day where there was no obstacle. So I'd much rather have the obstacle be part of the process than some shit that I got to deal with when I really don't want to.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, Steve, this has been so great. Thank you so much for your time. I'm looking forward to reading Love is Just Damn Good Business. And thanks for just making my day that much better. Just the way you show up and share your life's work, it means a lot to me. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Chris. It's been a real pleasure chatting with you. And what a great conversation. I look forward to more.
The question I have for you at the end of this episode is this. How will you bring love into your business as a discipline and a practice? This is definitely a question that I'll be thinking about as it relates to everything that I do in the future, from this podcast and all the projects that I work on to every customer interaction. Until next time, may creativity and curiosity fuel your life.